Hey everyone, it is Vodka O'Clock, and I'm Amber Love of AmberUnmasked.com. And this episode, I want to remind you that in just a couple days, October 6th and 7th, is the New Jersey Superhero Weekend at Comic Fusion, which raises money for domestic violence victims through a comic art auction and other really fun activities. There will be tons of cosplay. We're going to have a face painter, and we're going to have artists inside the store, and the local gourmet dog boutique place is going to have dog costume contests. So that's October 6th and 7th. Please come visit us in Flemington, New Jersey. You can go to comicfusion.com and click the Wonder Woman Day button to learn more. So joining me today is Stephen Blackmore, one of my favorite Twitter people. He's the author of City of the Lost, and we're here to talk about his work and other buzzing topics in the literary world. So Stephen, welcome aboard here to Vodka O'Clock.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm drinking this weird, hellacious cocktail of apricot brandy, orange juice, and one of the vodkas that was in a flask that I found in my room. And it's not too bad, I guess, once you get a few swigs in. So do you have a drink of choice?
You know, I've got a glass of Bowmore scotch right here.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
That's scotch is my drink.
It was my drink for a very long time, too. So how's let's talk about City of the Lost. It only came out, was it the early this year or was it actually last year?
It came out early this year, actually January. And wow, it's still 2012. It feels so much longer.
So give us a rundown. It was sort of like a sci-fi thriller sort of thing going on.
Well, it's been labeled as urban fantasy, and it's kind of picked up a few other labels, I guess. Zombie noir is one of the things that seems to have stuck with it.
That's a fun label.
It's really a crime novel that happens to be paranormal rather than I think a lot of the other urban fantasies out there, which is more the other way around. So it's very violent and there's a lot of swearing and it's pretty graphic.
That's why we get along so well.
Yeah.
Our Twitter feeds people. God, you really need to be following us. I know Stephen's Twitter handle is S Blackmore.
Yes, it's very original.
Yeah, and spell his name correctly. It's Black Moore, and I'm at Elizabeth Amber. And we are a hoot and a half on the Twitter. So, and of course, you know, my partner in crime, Ashley, loves you dearly on the Twitter as well. She's smashes nerdy. So, since City of the Lost has come out, was this, let me figure this out, was this your first standalone novel? Because I know you do a lot of anthology work, too.
This is my first novel, and I've been in a few anthologies, had some short stories published. So for a long time, it was just short stories, and this is kind of kicked off into. I've got a second one coming out in February by the same publisher, Daw Books, called Dead Things, which is sort of a follow up. It's really it's in the same world but different characters, and I'm working on a book for Evil Hat Games called Con of Mars, which is part of their Spirit of the Century Dinocalypse Kickstarter that they did a few months ago. So I'm in the middle of working on that, and just trying to figure out what my next moves are.
Okay, and were you, I know that we sort of travel in the same circles anyway, were you also part of the Feeding Kate?
Yes. Yeah, I actually have a story that's going to be in that, and I actually turned it in a couple of weeks ago. So there's also another Kickstarter short story thing that I'm going to be doing for a a game, I guess, supplement. I'm not entirely sure how it's being put together, called Village by the Sea. And me and a few other authors are going to be doing short stories for that. And I think that's it at the moment.
Well, that's a lot. So are you full-time writer, or do you have some sort of suck day job?
I've got a suck day job. Okay. I do have a suck day job because, you know, writing doesn't actually pay.
And the bills, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, things like health insurance, which is always fun. I've got the suck day job, so that that takes up pretty much all my day. So I end up writing at night.
And now I'm very curious about how you can accomplish that and achieve that, because my friend James Hannon said that he, when he's at his suck day job, he spends exactly 1 hour at lunchtime with a laptop, and that's how he got his book done. Now, I mean, my schedule changes, it's very sporadic, but I do a few temp things, and when I get out of an office environment, I don't want to look at another computer for the rest of the night.
Yeah, no, I have a similar problem. For a long time, I was doing exactly that, going, you know, working in an office and then spending an hour at lunch. But when I got home, I really just had to take the time to spend a couple hours and just write. Otherwise, I'd never get anything done. And now it's ironically a little worse because I'm working from home. So I actually get out of bed, walk into my office, and I don't leave for the entire day and sometimes late into the night because, you know, it's like, okay, done working, now I have to go write, and then sitting down and working on that. And, you know, there are days that go by where I haven't gotten my ass out of the chair for 5-6 hours at a stretch.
Right, and that's so terrible. I mean, when I'm sitting in an office chair like that, I'm just thinking, wow, I can feel the blood clots forming.
Yes, yes.
But hey, you can be part of, you know, the pantsless party.
I'm not wearing pants now.
Fantastic. See, I was naked all day, so I actually opted to put clothes on for you.
Oh, you're a giver.
I know. I try really hard. But this is, you know, and you've got a family and a dog to feed. How's your dog? He had a
dog
birthday.
Dog is good. I actually have two dogs. I have Angus, who is a meathead of a Labrador, and Emma, who is a Lab Irish Wolfhound, who is a little skittish but very, very sweet. I'm looking at them right now. They're racked out on the floor, staring up at me, wondering why I'm not giving them food.
Is she gigantic? Irish Wolfhound?
No. Well, yeah, when we got her, she was a rescue, and when we got her, she was a runt of the litter, and she had survived parvo. Wow. So, I mean, she was just really, really small when we got her, and she's more lab than she is Irish Wolfhound, fortunately. So she's not huge. She's actually smaller than Angus. She thinks she's bigger.
Well, see, usually I think, don't the big dogs usually think that they're smaller and they try to, like, get up on your lap?
Yes.
Or get into the tiniest little places?
Well, Angus does that all the time. He's about 90 pounds and thinks he's 20 and decides frequently to jump on me and decide that my lap is where he needs to be.
Now, this is an interesting, weird, offshoot writing question here involving the dogs. It seems cat people, like me, we tend to look at the cats as material. Like, they are source material. Do you have the same thing with dogs? Because, I mean, at least in comics anyway, we, you know, it's just cats are so much fun to put into comics. So, I mean, do you write the dogs into the stories or anything?
No, not I haven't. That actually hasn't occurred to me. They don't really.
They're not that motivational.
Yeah, they've certainly got character, but most of the stuff I write, I wouldn't want to put him into, just, you know. I got City of the Lost has a scene where a dog gets killed, and I got some comments about that. So it's one of those things that I don't really, you know, don't really look at them as source material for that sort of thing.
Well, you know, and it's interesting that you bring that up, that you did something so traumatic, and you're obviously a dog lover and an animal lover. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was what the worst thing is that you've ever done to a character, in your opinion, because, you know, when I read, like, Chuck Wendig's books and Dwayne Swarzynski's books, I mean, they can muster some of the most horrific things to do to characters. And, you know, but what I think is horrific might not be to them. They might just think it's hilarious. So I was wondering what you think the worst thing you've ever done to a character is.
Huh. Wow.
I mean, because killing a dog is pretty bad. But, I mean, it might have been quick and...
Well, yeah. And I think there's a... There's actually a scene in the next book, in Dead Things, that is a sort of protracted, I think, murder scene that the protagonist is forced to watch, and he can't do anything about it. And at the end of it, some things happen. I don't want to say anything because it'd be kind of spoilery, but they leave him pretty devastated. And I found myself, when I wrote that, and when I go back and read that, it's one of the few scenes that I've written that actually bothers me at the end of it. Because one of the things that I really want to do in my writing is not pull punches. You know, there's a difference between doing something just, you know, gratuitously and doing something that you know is going to have an impact. You're doing it for a reason. And so a scene like that, I debated, because it bothered me as much as it did, I debated whether or not I actually wanted to take it in that direction. And there are a couple of scenes in City of the Lost where I looked at the same thing afterward and going, really, should I have done that? And decided to keep them in, because otherwise it felt like a cop-out.
Well, that's good, though. That's good. I mean, it shows how much care you put into the whole process. I mean, I want to see, you know, I know that, you know, I love movies with blood and bullets, and that's going to be all this is. I mean, you sat and you worried about it.
I wonder sometimes if I worried more about what other people's reactions would be.
We already think you're a sick bastard.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much who I am. So, I do want to. I think every writer does this, even the ones who are just so hammered on their deadline that they're just looking to say, I just got to get this thing out. I think every writer cares about their work.
I don't know that that's always true, but I think they do.
And it may not look the same way to every person. But I think we're always looking at, okay, did I just do something that just sucks? You know, I mean, we are being judged by our work, whether we want to be or not. And I think we all are paying attention to that as much as possible. Some may not see whether or not, you know, what they've done is good or not good. And I think I'm starting to babble now. So
that's okay. So I mean, I'm gonna assume that you're an outliner. Do you outline?
Yeah. Outlining and I have a weird relationship. I know some people.
Yeah.
Who,
are you the catcher? Are you?
Yes. yeah, I just grab my ankles. I know some people who sit down and they write out a very detailed outline, and that's it. And they do that. And for a long time, I couldn't outline. I wrote City of the Lost without an outline. And it wasn't until I got to my agent who looked at it and said, you know, here are some issues with it, and me trying to figure out how I was going to sort of keep track of all the changes I was going to make to the manuscript, that he kind of forced me into outlining. And so I outlined the whole thing, and from there it was much easier, because then I could figure out it's easier to sort of dismantle a 20-page document than a 300-page document.
Absolutely.
So doing that really helped. So now, when it comes to larger projects, I absolutely outline. I hate it, but it's really helped with that. I don't think I could have written my second book without that outline.
That's the thing, is most people that I ask, they say that they outline. So it's you're the first. You're the first that said that you didn't outline for your first book.
Oh.
But you had an agent. Now, did you already have an agent because of the short story work?
No, actually. I have my agent is Alan Guthrie. He's also a crime writer in Scotland. And I actually got him because a friend of mine suggested that I talked to him, and I had no idea he was an agent. I said, "What are you talking about? The guy's an author." He says, "No, he's an agent," and we hit it off really well. In just, you know, I talked to him over email, and he looked over the manuscript and came back and said, "I like it, but," and he was able to tell me not just what he thought didn't work, but also what he thought might work to fix it. And that worked out really well. A lot of people I've spoken to, and I think every writer has run into this, finding good readers who can tell you what's actually wrong with the manuscript is tough. Because it's not just a matter of, finding someone who can do that, but also who can communicate it back to you in a way that you understand. And he was able to do that. So when we had a few conversations about that, he ended up taking me on as a client. And from that point on, it was many, many rewrites to get the book done.
How long did it actually take for City of the Lost? I mean, some people, they churn away at something that they started, you know, for 10 years.
This one was kind of weird because I had the idea, and that was probably 2003, 2004. And could not make it work. I kept trying, and every scene that I wrote was just crap. At one point, it ended up reading like a buddy cop movie. It was horrible. It didn't work at all. And so I let it go for a couple of years, and then it just kept coming back. So I figured, you know, I'm just going to write a short story and put... and just get it out of my system. I'll have that. It'll be done. I can just ignore it from this point on. Wrote that, and that got published in Spine Tingler magazine online I can't remember what the hell what it was called. Oh, And the Devil Will Drag You Under was the title.
Okay.
And that turned into the first three or four chapters of City of the Lost. Because, again, I couldn't let go of it. I just kept coming back to it. So I ended up sitting down finally and writing this thing out and using that as a jumping point, a jump-off point, to get the rest of the book. So all told, from the time I came up with the idea, about 6 years. But actual concentrated writing it after I did that short story, probably about 2 or 3. I know some people who've their first novel, you know, has taken 10 years or more.
Yeah, that's. I was going to say I've talked to people and they've toiled away for 7 years.
Yeah, and sometimes that shows more in their second novel. You know,
so what was the process for the second novel like?
Well, for that I actually did an outline from the beginning, and that was that one was going back and forth again with my agent because he's also just a very good editor as well. So I ended up writing, at first it was like a one-page synopsis, and say, okay, we need a little more detail here and here, and then sat and did some more and passed it back and forth, and by the end of it, I had a 30-page outline for Dead Things. And I talking to people about the length of the outlines that they did, and they look at me and said, that's insane, I only did 4. You know, okay, well, great, you know. So it worked from... if I hadn't had that outline, I would have just been all over the place. And
I would think so. I would think that you would need some sort of guidance, unless you specifically know, like, you have that epiphany where you're in the shower and you're like, this is my story, I want to write it. No matter what, this is the ending I'm going to get to.
Right. And I know some people who can do that. And with stories, for me, I have no idea how it's going to end from the time I start, but I don't really have to worry about that when I've only got 6,000 words. When you know, you're doing, you know, 60 to 100, that doesn't really work.
Yeah, that's different. I mean, a short story, it's one of the things that I like about short stories is that they tend to leave things open for, you know, for the mystery, for, you know, let people wonder what's happening and, you know, let their imaginations take over because you've taken them to a certain place, now let them live there.
I've heard that described it that way a few times. One of the things that I've heard was that it opens up the world at the end, as opposed to closing it down. And in a lot of novels, you really have to close it because you've got this long arc of the story, and we want a resolution. Whatever that resolution is, we want to have that locked down. And in a short story, it tends to benefit from remaining in the question at the end.
Yeah, and I know because it gets even you know, more of a question when you're talking about something like flash fiction, where you're talking about something really super short. And, you know, over at Chuck Wendig's blog, Terrible Minds, he does a lot of flash fiction contests. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the comments that I think is most prevalent on somebody's flash fiction is, oh, I want more. And it's really hard as a writer to know if that's an insult or a compliment. Like what?
Well, yeah, it really depends on what you were trying to do with it, I think. And I think flash fiction is difficult because when you're dealing with less than 1,000 words, it's easier to write a scene than necessarily an entire story. I think a lot of people who are new to, say, horror fiction run into that. H.P. Lovecraft was horrible for that. Where you read some of his stuff and realize there's no actual story there. There's just this scene of oh my god, Eldritch horror, you know, and that, mm-hmm. that's it. And flash fiction, being able to do a whole story in flash fiction can suffer from that, where people just end up writing a scene that doesn't really go anywhere, and doesn't really say much. I think though that with more and more of it out there, people are able to see and work with that. I think the quality of flash fiction that I've seen in the last year or so, especially with some of the websites out there that are promoting more flash fiction, is certainly better than it used to be.
Yeah, and I mean I agree, and like you're saying, it's such a short amount that to me it's like a vignette. It's, you know, the thought of trying to finish something. I think that you should be happy that you've sort of been teased. But maybe that's an evolution of what shorter fiction has become.
I think it can be. That's the thing about short stories in general, is they can be anything. You don't necessarily need to follow a particular rule. If you just want to write a vignette or just want to write a scene, that can work. Sometimes it doesn't. And I think that...
it has to have purpose. No, I mean, it still has to have purpose.
I agree. Yeah, otherwise it's, you know, you're just kind of babbling.
Right. Absolutely. Do you approach your short stories very differently than, you know, you finally nail down the whole outlining process for these big long novels? So, you know, do you approach a short story in such a way that you know that you need to hit a certain word count, or do you just say, you know, I need to tell this succinctly and I need to just watch the structure?
A lot of what I focus on is voice rather than plot. I think plot's probably my weaker area, actually. And particularly with a short story, the first line is really the important part. If I can't come up with a first line that really grabs my attention, I know it's not going to work, and I know I'm not going to be happy with it. When it comes to hitting a particular word count, I view it as a problem sometimes, and sometimes it's a strength, I think, is that I underwrite. I will never write a 1,200 page epic anything. It's not going to happen. My books are short. My short stories, if I go over 4,000 words on a short story, it's unusual. I've got a few that I think clock in at about 7,000, and those are rare for me because I tend to lose steam. I'm really not big on a really big word count. So what I will usually do is I'll start with an opening line, which, you know, what does that kind of show for me in a particular scene, and take it from there, and I may not know even what the hell I'm talking about for the first half. And then something will click, and I'll say, "Okay, this is what this story is about." And then I'll know where to take it from there. And then at the end of it, I'll end up looking at it and say, "Okay, great, I have to tack on another 1,000 words in here, and have to grow it more." So it ends up being sort of an iterative process. Occasionally, I'll write something in one shot, and go, "Okay, yeah, done," But most of the time I have to go back and either cut things or add things. It really is true that that writing is rewriting, at least in my case.
I think that's true for most people, except me. I don't know, maybe poets, I don't know. But everybody, I think, you know, tries to edit a little bit.
Yeah, I think for me, it's there's definitely a lot of editing that has to be done, mostly to add word count rather than pull.
And now, is this some sort of, you know, writing in general and editing? To me, editing is a different skill. But are these skills that you learned formally, you know, through, you know, high school or college or something? Or is this just the way that you've developed your, you know, in your spare time?
I think a little of both. Mostly just from reading and wanting to tell stories and wanting to write. I think a lot of my voice as a writer has definitely come out of a couple of creative writing courses that I took that helped a lot, and I think for the most part though, my writing's come out of wanting to tell stories and seeing. Example, you know, just reading a lot.
So why do you think that you were compelled to start creating your own as opposed to sticking with reading? I mean, it's one of those things where when you sort of get wrapped up in fiction, people do both. You know, you know, usually if you're an avid reader, you're going to somehow dabble on your own. Anyway, but you took the step to say, you know, I'm going to go into professional writing. So, you know, was there a moment where you made that decision and you like were consciously aware of it, or was it just like, you know, you're putting things out there and somebody said, hey, let me publish that?
I've wanted to be a writer, I think, since I can remember wanting to do it in high school. Trying to get some things published and getting, you know, your typical form letter rejections at 15 and pretty much stopping for years. But I think that's always been there. I think I've always wanted to be a storyteller. I think that when I was younger, I used to play a lot of pen and paper role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons and Traveler and you know, games like that, and I think that actually informed a lot of how I approach writing, for like outlines. All outlines end up reading the same as game adventures that I'd write when I was a kid. Hopefully they're a little more sophisticated then.
Right. But I was actually going to ask you that because it's amazing the couple of times that I've played D&D, the amount of work that goes into actually mapping out a campaign. I mean, I was lucky that I had played at the comic shop one time with somebody who, he took such amazing care and effort into writing this whole thing. And it was like, it wasn't like it was a big epic. I mean, we did spend all day doing it, but it was, it, you know, it was still a matter of just, you know,
players,
leaving one thing, going into one tower, and you had, you know, to accomplish a goal. But it was, there was so much thought and care put into every single step.
I think players are less forgiving than readers. Because there's an immediate feedback. If you're running a campaign and you screw something up or you say or do something that doesn't make sense, your players will savage you. they'll call you on your shit because it with gaming, unlike novels or comics or television or movies or anything like that, it's collaborative. It's real time collaborative. You don't have one person telling this story to four or five people. You have, you know, four or five people all telling each other this story. And with that kind of immediate feedback, if you have an idea of the direction of the story you want to tell, you really have to get those things locked down. But at the same time, you have to be as open and flexible as possible, because players will derail any well thought out campaign. And I think for me, getting that kind of interaction, that kind of real time feedback on a story that I've created, was really useful. It made me hate some people,
right?
But learning that kind of I guess real time rejection in some ways, is really useful, because it certainly helped me to adapt and get past being so invested in what the story is going to end up looking like at the end.
Well, I mean, people want to win. I mean, so if you're talking about players, I mean, players want to win. They want to get the trophy at the end of the campaign, whatever it is, you know, kiss the girl, get the, you know, idol from
when there's that kind of goal-oriented play. In high school, when I was playing a lot, I actually met some exchange student in Sweden, and it turned out that we were both playing the same games, but the way they were going about doing it, their whole game was they were playing negotiation. They were they were playing characters who were ambassadors, and they were trying to. There was a lot of interaction with non-player characters, with each other. There was a lot of role play there, as opposed to the kind of gaming that I was doing, which was, hey, let's go in and kill a bunch of orcs, and they were appalled by me.
Right.
I'm telling, oh yeah, we just spend the whole time killing everything in sight, and they had a very different take on game. For them, it wasn't goal oriented. They weren't looking to win anything. They were actually, obviously, they were trying to attain whatever goals they had for themselves. But they were very dedicated to the story, and that actually was a lesson for me, to focus more on the story, and kind of changed my perspective on a lot of things, just dealing with that particular experience.
Well, I think it's fascinating the way that games have developed, especially transitioning. There's, I mean, tabletop games are still a booming industry, but there's but now with video game RPGs, the MMOs, it's, to me, it's amazing to know that there are writers behind that. Like, you know, one of my friends that I've never met, the beloved Troy Hickman, worked on City of Heroes, and when we were talking, and all of a sudden he got like this, you know, his first writing gig on City of Heroes. I thought this was amazing. I'm like, what do you mean you write for a video game? How do you write for a video game that people play? What's there for you to do? Like, I didn't get it. And it's because I'm not like this huge hardcore gamer, so I didn't really understand the gaming concepts. But you know, when you think about that, every single element has got a story, and that you know, as a player, you go, you check in with some kind of handler of some sort, and you get some sort of mission. And, you know, and you have to go and you have to, you know, achieve it or fail it. And what happens then? And now there's actors involved, this to me is so mind-blowing. It's like there's actors that their jobs on listed on IMDb are being in video games.
It's I think that as the technology gets more sophisticated and we get past the kind of mechanics that you see in a game like City of Heroes, where which is pretty linear. You go and like you said, you go to your handler, you get your quest, you go do this thing, you come back, you get your experience points, you go on to the next thing. That I think that's going to shift, and I think it's going to require. I think it's already shifting, and I think it's going to require a different kind of storytelling. That we're sort of in the process of developing, and it's already out there. You look at games like Skyrim or Fallout, which are these huge world. You're not constrained in any way. You can go and do things in whatever order. And I think that requires a different mindset for storytelling, and it's, I think, a lot more convoluted than anything that one can do in a novel. Or you look at a lot of the transmedia stuff that goes out there, where you're not just covering different media, you know, things like the alternate reality games, where you have things going on websites, you're getting mysterious midnight phone calls, you're getting emails, you know, things like that, where the story is being promoted through all of these different avenues, and it's a very different way of telling a story. And I think that video games are going to start seeing, I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that as the technology continues to grow.
Yeah, and I don't even know that that's constrained to video games, because television shows obviously have embraced it, and so has publishing, where there's so much crossover now. Like, you know, Castle's one of my favorite shows. I love Castle.
The novels that, the novels that have been put out supposedly by that author.
By this fictitious person. And they did the same thing in Murder, She Wrote. You know, they had Jessica Fletcher books. But to think that if Murder, She Wrote was, you know, fresh and on the air today, what that would be like, the fact that there would be, you know, somebody tweeting as Jessica Fletcher, like the way that there's somebody tweeting as Richard Castle. Yes. And there's also, like, all these interaction things, like you're saying, you can go to a website and they'll have these little... little games, you know, like on Psych, you can play these, go to the Psych USA website and play these weird games, or you can have live chats with the actors or live chats with the creators. And the commentary tracks on the DVDs are like my favorite thing. So it's like, I, you know, to think about if you, you know, you put out a really successful book series, and just, you know, that there's podcast commentaries dedicated to it. It's like, once you've been hooked on something, like, I mean, the Harry Potter world is just, it's like absurd the way it exists. It's almost everywhere. And the fact that there's an amusement park dedicated to it now. I mean,
well, I think also when you look at like Harry Potter, for example, look at also the fan fiction.
Right.
You know, people are growing the stories themselves that they want to tell, and it's the world, and after a particular point, it takes on its own life, and other people are creating it and promoting it and doing that, and it's just going to get bigger. You know, at some point Harry Potter will peter out, but I think it's going to take a long time. Particularly because you have people writing fan fiction, but something else will take its place. There's always going to be something that people will find that they want to be a part of, and so they'll grow that.
Go ahead.
There was a thing at Sundance that actually Chuck Wendig got me involved with a couple of years ago. It was a transmedia, I guess game is the way to call it. Maybe experience is better. That they were it was called Pandemic, and it was sort of centered around a short film that they had at Sundance, and it was this zombie plague sort of situation. And what my involvement was to write a short fiction piece, and also to write tweets from the character in that piece. So there was that aspect of the short fiction, and there was also the story unfolding on Twitter from these characters who were in these various stories, and there was also the event actually happening at Sundance, which was a rather convoluted treasure hunt. And they all tied together, and this thing went across 4 days. And that's kind of a small aspect, or a small example of a lot of the transmedia stuff that's out there. There was when Halo, I think it was Halo 2 came out, there was I Love Bees that was going on the web and in other spaces as well. And we're seeing more and more and more of that. I know that it's gotten huge. I know Chuck's been involved in a lot of it. There's an author, Andrea Phillips. She's been involved with that for a long time, and it's I think gaining more and more traction because we've got these ways to tell stories now that we didn't have 20 years ago. And, you know, 5-10 years from now, how are we going to be telling stories? What avenues are we going to have through that? You know, right now we can tell stories through Twitter. We can tell stories on Facebook. We can tell stories through text messages.
I have. It was one of those things. I was hashtagging epic tweets last winter because I had literally lost my mind, completely lost my shit. Driving through New Jersey in a snowstorm, trying to chisel my car out from layer upon layer of ice and, you know, trees down everywhere and still trying to get to a job. And it was so slow going, and I would have to stop so often that I just kept stopping and tweeting and hashtagging epic tweets. And it was just this insane quasi sci-fi fantasy thing that I had going where like my ice scraper was a big giant sword that I had, you know, clobbered the ice off of my mechanical steed. And
right. And 10 years ago, you could not have, you couldn't have had that avenue to tell a story. There was a thing a few years ago. I think it was one of the anniversaries of the War of the Worlds radio play. And I don't think it got a lot of coverage, but a few people, I know a few people out here in LA were a part of it. They were doing on Twitter, sort of a real time.
Oh yeah, they were doing the real time, you know. And I think I'm not sure, but I think somebody actually did that for the Hindenburg too.
Right. You've got and you've got the ability to do that now. And
like they've completely faked the news as if it was, you know, 1950 whatever.
I'm fascinated to see what we're going to come up with next. We've got so many possibilities just right now. I don't think anybody's really. I think that the next big. I don't know. Step, I guess, is going to be more photos and video. Because we've got those things, I mean, everybody's got an iPhone at this point, or an Android, or whatever, and you can take video and you can take photos, and you're already seeing stuff, you know, memes on with captions online. At some point, someone's going to, or more likely several people all at the same time, are going to come up with something that's different enough that they're going to advance it into the next big thing. And I'm just fascinated to see what that's going to end up being.
Do you care about that when you're writing? Do you care about how you're going to market and viral your product out there?
Not when I'm writing. For me, I want to just tell the story. I'm more concerned that I'm putting together something that people like. Because really, it's, you know, when say and every writer says this. Oh, I'm writing for myself. You know, yeah, you are, but for the most part, that's bullshit. You're writing for an audience. Otherwise, you wouldn't be putting it out there for people. There's an almost narcissistic.
You would just be keeping a journal otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm really not thinking about is this going to be successful? Are people, you know, is this going to make me a lot of money or anything like that? It's wow, this thing sucks. What can I do to fix it? That's really what's more in my head. So, it's afterward, and like right now, I'm trying to figure out, okay, how I've got this book coming out in February. How can I best get people to know about it and be interested in it without beating them over the head with spam?
Right. Well, yeah, you gotta hook yourself a celebrity.
Well, over the place here, I can just drive down the street.
You're in LA, yeah. I can imagine you can just wrangle one.
Yeah, I'll find some D-lister, you know.
You know, I heard Lindsay Lohan might not be busy right now.
Actually, that or she's in jail again, I'm not sure.
She could be, but she's captive, so you have her attention. But you brought up something that I really wanted to talk to you about, which was you brought up fan fiction. And recently, I mean, not only has, you know, 50 Shades of Grey blown up the publishing world, but 50 Shades of Grey has its own fan fiction that got some sort of like multi-million-dollar publishing deal.
That's some weird Escher shit right there. That's like being standing between two mirrors and just watching it kind of, you know, extend into the distance.
Yeah, like, I mean, what are your feelings about the fact that, you know, not only did fan fiction get published, but fan fiction of fan fiction got this, you know, bajillion-dollar deal that other novelists would slit their wrists to get?
I know I'm going to get shit for saying this, but I think it's pretty cool, actually.
Is it hopeful?
Oh, I think so. I think so. You know, here's the thing about there's the difference between writing and publishing, and they're surprisingly not as compatible, I think, as people would like them to be. You know, when we're writing, we're trying to either we're either focusing on crafts, some people are focusing on art, or just trying to tell a good story, or trying to be funny, or whatever they're trying to do, they're focused on that story. When it actually comes to publishing, then it turns into money, and
right.
Things get really weird at that point. And some publishers are definitely going to look at this and go, "Hey, you know what? This will make us a mint. Let's do this." I don't believe in sacred cows. You know, I don't like the idea that something is somehow inviolate. And when if somebody comes up with something that a publisher is willing to put money into, I don't see that as a bad thing. you know, more power to these people who are writing, you know, fanfic or slashfic or, you know, some 50 Shades of Grey clone. And if they're able to find success, that's great. I'm happy for them. I may not read their stuff. I may not like it. But I don't look at it as, oh my God, the apocalypse has come. you know, one of the things that really bugs me is, particularly with the thing with 50 Shades of Grey, I don't have much of an opinion on the book. I'm fascinated by its implications, but I haven't read it. And so I have a hard time saying, oh my God, what a horrible thing. Well, I don't know if it's a horrible thing because I haven't read the book. But a lot of people seem to want to dismiss it just because whatever reason. I mean, I've heard bits of it, and the bits that I've heard and the bits that I've seen are actually pretty bad.
Oh yeah, me too. I read the most hilarious Goodreads reviews.
Did you see the guy who did the voice acting for Duke Nukem?
No.
Shades. It's out on YouTube. It's hysterical. But yeah, it's pretty. There are parts of that are pretty atrocious writing.
But one of the other things, I mean, you're also, you know, besides being a fiction writer, you're also an avid blogger with your site. And it's LA Noir. What's the actual link?
Oh, for LA Noir?
Yeah.
It's la-noir.blogspot.com.
Okay, and not to be confused with the video game of the same name, because you were there first, let's face it.
Yes.
But you know, one of the reasons that I reached out to you at this particular time was because you had brought up all of the problems that are going on in publishing with the paid reviews and the fake reviews, and you know the how you're not sure what to believe on Amazon because a lot of those IDs might be completely fake, and so I want to talk about that, and I want to also I posted to Twitter and never got a real clear response onto if authors prefer reviews on Goodreads or on Amazon, because Amazon is going to be the buying market, but Goodreads is like this literary community where we share when something is great or sucks. So, you know, without taking into consideration, here's where you buy it. So, you know, what was your whole stance on the reviews that have been going on lately?
Just like in terms of the paid versus non-paid kinds of...
Right, because it's like when I first heard about this as a controversy, I was like, well, what's wrong with paying somebody for their time? I mean, it takes a considerable amount of time to read a book. You know, so it's like, yeah you
and
might get the free file, but who cares?
This actually just reminded me of what the hell I had forgot halfway through.
Oh, fantastic.
Readers don't care. That's the gist of what I was getting at before, and I think it ties into this. As writers, we get all tied up in this inside baseball crap about rankings and reviews and all that. But readers don't they not only aren't aware, I think, of most of it, but they just give a rat's ass. They see a book, they read the book, they like the book. Okay, so you know we can rally against bad writing in 50 Shades of Grey all we want, but if everybody's reading it, that's telling us something. And
some people though are reading that because it's bad.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, well, yeah, absolutely. Everybody's got their own reason for it. It's not like, you know, this has gone out and every single person is who's reading it is, you know, just totally sucked into it. There are people who are buying it just to figure out what the big deal is.
Right.
And I think that's always been the case for situations like this. I'm sure that most of the people who read that what the hell's your name, Snooki? From
Oh God, yeah, I think she has like two books. What is that about?
I'm willing to bet that most of the people who read that read it because they wanted to see what kind of train wreck it was. So yeah, absolutely. There are people who are reading that they've all got different reasons, and I think this kind of feeds into that whole argument about the paid versus non-paid. Readers are going to go if they're looking at reviews. I think Goodreads probably doesn't help in terms of sales. I honestly don't know. I'm sure Amazon does. But I don't think most readers, and obviously I could be wrong with this, but I don't think most readers are going to Amazon and digging beyond the first page.
The first page. Yeah, that's pretty much what I would stick to.
Like, why do I – this guy says it sucks. Well, why do I want to go and look at five other pages of things saying it sucks? Or this one says it's great. Why do I want – you know, it's – I think word of mouth is still going to be the better way to get people to read things. Amazon reviews did not – make The Hunger Games as successful as it has been. When it comes to things like the paid reviews, I understand why people are doing it. I understand that they're looking at it at that point as I created a product that I am selling. And to an extent, I think they're right. I think that's only part of the story, though. You know, we come up with a book and we want it to be successful. We want people to read it, and we want people to like it, and by extension, like us as writers. And so, we want to get the book out there. We want people to read it. Some people, though, I think don't get past the thought of I have a product here, and so. That kind of creates this idea of, well, then I have to crush my competition, you know, or I have to be better than my competition. How can I?
Right, and that's where we got into the fake reviews, right?
Into the fake reviews, and I think also into the fake and negative reviews. There was a thing where one crime writer was writing bad reviews about another, and this is a few weeks ago. I think it was what the guy's name was, but he was talking shit about Stuart McBride, who if you haven't read Stuart McBride's stuff, he's fantastic. He's a really, really excellent author. But he's just talking shit about him under an anonymous name in Amazon reviews, and that just takes it, that I think takes it another step, where it's not just I have to make my product seem better than everybody else's, but now I have to go and stomp on this other person to get him out of my way. I'm sorry, but that doesn't really work.
It doesn't. It doesn't, because it's being a piss poor human being. But why is publishing different? Because let me tell you, I've been in software, I've been in engineering, I've been in pharmaceuticals. I have like the resume of a gypsy, and in every single one of those jobs, there's been somebody who gets pleasure from bringing other people down. Especially in government, I was in politics too. So
every industry has that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, when all of a sudden my Twitter feed blew up with this, you know, just alarming buzz about how, yes, faking anything is bad. Faking an orgasm is bad. I mean, fuck that. I mean, faking anything is bad.
Right.
So, you know, but publishing should not think that it is any different than any other business.
Yes. Yes, and I see what you're talking about. And I think that's where you run into that schism between writing and publishing. And I've heard this put a few different ways, but writing is about books and publishing is about money.
Yeah.
And when you've got, I think a lot of writers have problems with the idea that once they've written this, for some of them, what they call art, suddenly becomes a commodity, and something that they spent years working on. They put a lot of their effort, their creativity, they in some cases they've suffered for it, you know, and then suddenly it goes out and they get a publisher and several things could happen. Nobody reads it, or they get screwed over on a book deal, or you know, whatever. It's jading, and I think that there's a myth that publishing is somehow different, and you're right, it's not different. It's an industry like any other.
I think that's what happens, is that publishing, people look at it and they even to an extent do this with comic book publishing, which I think is hilarious sometimes. The general public looks at it differently. The fan base looks at it differently than any other form of entertainment. Like, they think of Hollywood, that Hollywood is there to make money. But no. Let's remember, these are huge conglomerate corporations that own these houses. So publishing is, you know, it might be your favorite romance novel. It might be your favorite, you know, children's tween angst series. It might be any one of those things, or it might be your favorite comic book title. They are still a business, and they are still out to make money, and you can't think that it's any different than Hollywood.
Yes. Now where I think that that shifts is not in the overall, but in the in some of the smaller companies, or even down to when it gets down to individual people.
Sure, like creator-owned work, definitely totally different.
The creator-owned stuff, you know, yeah, there's a lot going on in self-publishing, which is, you know, I'm all for self-publishing. I am not all for self-publishing bad work, which unfortunately there's a lot. But I'm talking also more about companies and individual editors, or you know, where they're trying to balance the idea of making money with putting out stuff that they really care about. There's a phrase, you can do good and do well. You know, you can focus on doing the right thing and at the same time be successful. And I think there are some companies that are actually really good at doing that, on focusing on the writer or the artist or the musician or whatever. Couple examples, the publisher I'm with, DAW, has been around forever, and they're probably the biggest small publisher out there. They're still independently owned. They've got a distribution deal with Penguin, so they're affiliated with Penguin, but they're not part of Penguin. So they will sometimes, I've heard an interview with my editor to saying exactly this. They might pick up a book that they'll say, you know, this may not make us a lot of money, but we really like it. We really want this book to be out there. And they're in a position to be able to do that. And you have companies like Angry Robot, which have been doing a lot of really innovative things, but key to that is that they're bringing in really good books. And then, like in the gaming space, you've got a company like Evil Hat, which I think they won an award recently for best, like, or favorite fan game company or something like that. And it makes sense because they not only care about what they're putting out, but they make a point of showing to everybody that they care, and they make some really good decisions. And I don't want to say that those are exceptions, because I don't know what everybody else is doing. But
I think it's a great example, though, to, you know, or a great key to bring up examples where there are publishers and companies that are willing to take a risk on something, because you know what, you know, in comics, you can get really lucky with a great book from Image Comics. You know, you can get find something that's an absolute original, unique sort of treasure, like Chew. You know, and these are not things that you will get necessarily turned into a $300 bajillion blockbuster movie. And that's
not going to be Iron Man.
Yeah, and that's all that a lot of other companies are going to care about. And you know, when it comes to, I don't know about publishing fiction, if it has the same effect that, with comics, but there seems to be so much politics involved in comics now. Like, people are, fans, just at the fan level, are really concerned with how many female writers there are, how many female editors there are. And I don't notice that. Maybe that's just one of those things where I just don't notice that with other traditional prose publishing.
I think the difference there is publishing, you know, publishing novels, you know, nonfiction, whatever. It's a more of a black box than comics are. I think people are paying attention to who the editors are in comics. They're paying attention to who the writers are and who the artists are, because it's this sort of whole package that you're getting.
Exactly. I mean, but yeah, I can tell you, like, my favorite novel series, I have no freaking idea who the agent is, who the editor is, who I can't even tell you who the publisher is. I can tell you who the author is because she created it and I love the book.
And that's what I mean by it's largely a black box. There is very little visibility there. At Worldcon, my editor won the Hugo for best long form editor, and in her speech she made a point of saying, most people don't know who we are. Nobody pays attention to the editors. Nobody has visibility to them, because their name isn't plastered on the front of the book. They're really behind the scenes, and nobody's really given that that level of visibility, or the readers aren't given visibility. And I think that kind of helps and hurts to an extent. On the one hand, it makes it, I think, easy for someone to say, "Oh, this is a Charlaine Harris novel," so right. You'll that it's, you know, a Charlaine Harris novel, and you follow Charlaine Harris, and she stops becoming an author, turns into a brand. And at the same time, if Charlaine Harris goes to another publisher and it's a different editor, you may end up with a very different book. I mean, that's probably, Charlotte Harris is probably a really bad example for that sort of thing, but
she's still an empire because of the Sookie Stackhouse novels becoming True Blood, which is so vastly different from the novels. So, you know, she's still cashing a paycheck of what's essentially not her work.
Oh, yeah, from the stuff for True Blood, yeah, of course. But I'm thinking more along the lines of just what the editor, people don't see the editors in publishing the way that they do in comics. I think where that hurts is it promotes a myth of the lone author as they're toiling away and they take their manuscript and it becomes a book and look, they made millions of dollars and they all did it themselves.
And it's still a team effort, right?
Just looking at, you know, cover art, formatting, editing, I mean, all these things just to come up with a book is pretty damn impressive.
Absolutely. And if you haven't seen the TED Talk with Chip Kidd about his cover design, he talks about design and he talks about how he made the Jurassic Park logo on TED Talk.
Yes, that's fascinating.
It was, and besides the fact that he's such a captivating speaker, and it's just, it's great to think of it as, I'm visual, you know, because, it's one of those things where, because I have sight, I am a visual consumer, so I will look at a book and say, wow, I really do like those covers. You know, I am a complete sucker in the cozy mystery section where when they are hot pink with neon green letters, I will pick it up to look at it and see what it is. And yet every urban fantasy in the tween angst section, they all look the same.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
Yeah, they do. But, I mean, Stephen, this has been so fantastic. I don't want to completely bogart all of your time. You've been so great on the show. I absolutely have adored having you.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been fun, and I hope I didn't babble on too much.
Babbling is good. It's podcasting. It's we're here to get to know you and enjoy you and time with you. So.
Well, thank you very much.
So let's get some last calls, if you will. Last call for your links. Because, as I said, on Twitter, you're S. Blackmore. So, once again, give us the L.A. Noir link.
It is la-noir, N-O-I-R, .blogspot.com. And I also blog at my personal site, stephenblackmore.com. That's there's two O's in that. If you go, I don't know if there's one with one, but there's another Stephen Blackmore out there. He's a Scottish botanist. Which who isn't me?
It's fantabulous because there's another Elizabeth Amber on Twitter, and she is like this acclaimed author, and I'm just like, but I got Elizabeth Amber. I'm like, I'm not her. I just wish I was. That's great, absolutely. So yeah, everybody, please follow us on Twitter. I'm Elizabeth Amber on Twitter, and you can find everything else you need to know at amberunmasked.com. Don't forget that in just a few days is the annual Superhero Weekend at Comic Fusion, also known as Wonder Woman Day, where we raise tons and tons of money for our local domestic violence shelter, and we have a great amount of fun at the store on that weekend, October 6th and 7th. We will have artists, we will have cosplayers, it'll be like a little mini Comic-Con all in an itty-bitty tiny space on Main Street in Flemington. So please look that up at comicfusion.com. And thank you again, Stephen. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Cheers.
Thanks for having me.